Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast, premiering Wednesday, October 1st. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
The Cuban Missile Crisis. The crisis is at hand. It is October 22nd, 23rd in Moscow. The Presidium meeting in the Kremlin. Nikita Khrushchev is the first secretary. The others at the table are critical. I turn to Serhii Plokhii, his new book, Nuclear Folly, A History of the Cuban Missile Crisis, using transcripts from the tape recordings that President Kennedy made of his meetings in the White House, using notes that were made at the Presidium meeting in Moscow. These two leaders of nuclear-tipped powered countries are unaware of what each other is saying, and their information is out of date, and it's often misunderstood by both sides. So we go now to the Presidium meeting late on the 22nd in Moscow. It's 8 hours ahead of Washington. They take a break in the middle of the evening. At this point, Professor, Khrushchev doesn't know what's going to happen, but there's a man at the table who has an alternative all the way through these discussions about deploying missiles. His name is Mikoyan. He has a great deal of authority on his own because he's one of the original revolutionaries. Who is he? What do we need to know about him at this point?
Anastas Mikoyan is a very, very interesting figure. The one who survived at the very top of the Soviet pyramid, power pyramid, as the member of the Presidium of Politburo from Vladimir Lenin to Leonid Brezhnev. He retired only in the 1960s. Of course, that means that he is a very experienced politician. But most of all, he's an excellent diplomat. And Khrushchev himself stated at some point that no one understands what Mikoyan says, but everyone believes that Mikoyan is a reasonable man. So that reasonable man indeed is there at the table. And he was against the idea of putting missiles on Cuba from the very beginning. He was trying to convince Khrushchev not to do that. But he failed. The missiles were put there. Mikoyan's concern was that it would actually could provoke a very strong response from the United States. He was in the United States before that. He knew Americans to a degree that Khrushchev didn't know. He was in Cuba. He met Fidel Castro. He knew that you can't hide missiles under the palm trees. So he had all this knowledge that others around the table didn't have. And he was a calming influence on Khrushchev in particular. Interestingly also that at this point, even the person who supported Khrushchev all the way, the Minister of Defense, Marshal Rodion Malinovsky, also tries to calm down Khrushchev and say that, well, if the speech is coming, they're not attacking right away. This is not that kind of a country. We will still have some time to react. So, but Khrushchev is really, his gamble backfired. He doesn't know what to expect. He is prepared to use missiles in case of the attack, the tactical nuclear weapons. The order to General Pliev, who is in charge of the Soviet troops in Cuba, is already there. It's drafted. It is not signed yet. They're waiting for the word from Washington. They're waiting to see what Kennedy have decided.
And the speech is in the middle of the night in Moscow. The Presidium stays in the Kremlin. Khrushchev sleeps in his suit. And the next morning, they meet again at 10 a.m. in the morning, Moscow time. This is the critical meeting for understanding what we're going to do in the event of catastrophe. The professor mentions the nuclear weapons that are on the missiles. There are other nuclear weapons, however. For example, there are tactical nuclear weapons that the U.S. never knows about. These are small battlefield weapons, and there are weapons of nuclear and torpedoes in the submarines. They are dispatching an armada that is reduced to a flotilla of Foxtrot, Hunter attack submarines. Does Washington know about the submarines at this point, Professor?
Washington doesn't know about the submarines. They would learn about that later. But Washington would never learn, at least during the crisis, that those submarines were equipped with the nuclear-armed torpedoes. So that was one of the things that Washington would never learn. Another thing was the presence of the tactical weapons. So really, the both sides act to a degree in a darkness. They don't understand each other fully, don't understand each other's motives. They don't know what the capabilities are on both sides. And again, Mikoyan, we were talking about Mikoyan. He is, again, someone who says, okay, please don't send the submarines there. Please keep them at a certain distance from the island. But the key decision that is made is that the Soviet Navy would not try to break through the blockade. They give an order to the Soviet ships that had missiles on their decks or in their trim decks to turn back. They give order to another ship that was close to Cuba and could beat the blockade, the ship which was called Alexandrovsk, and it had all the nuclear warheads for those missiles. They order that ship to go to Cuba as soon as possible. But the idea is actually try to avoid confrontation. As a result of that, only medium-range missiles ended up in Cuba. The intermediate one, the so-called R-14, that could reach areas beyond Washington and New York, they were turned back. So that was the immediate impact of President Kennedy's speech, which was, of course, very positive.
Back to the Washington on the 23rd, back and forth. We have a drama here with both sides guessing. This is the first official meeting of the Executive Committee for the NSC, the famous XCOM. Gathered around the table are men who are aware that the blockade is on, but what are we to do if the Soviets try to break through the blockade? Do we board the ships? Do we sink the ships? They don't know about the submarines yet, but they're about to learn about them. We do not know at this point what the chances are. However, the president, after exhausting himself all day long listening to these choices, says to his brother on tape after the people leave, everybody else leaves, "I do not think there was a choice. There was no choice. I had to do this." Professor, the way I read those remarks is that the president has doubts of himself at this point. How did you read them?
Well, they called the blockade quarantine, but they know that this is a blockade. They know that in the international law, this is an act of war. And Kennedy is very concerned about the nuclear confrontation, not in Cuba. He doesn't imagine that at this point, but in Central Europe over Berlin. And this is 1962. The United States acquired the hydrogen bomb in 1954. In 1961, the Soviets exploded the largest hydrogen bomb in the world history till today, the so-called Tsar Bomb. So they realize that both countries have the ability to destroy each other many times over. When Kennedy asks for estimate if they would, one of the Soviet missiles actually would get to the American soil, what would be the losses? The losses would be in hundreds of thousands. And that's again, you have to be inhuman not to question yourself to a degree what you are doing, not to think that through again and again and come back to that. So it's a very tense moment. But it's also interesting what Kennedy means when he says, "Okay, I didn't have a choice." because then there is a continuation. He says, I would be impeached. So at the end of the day, it's still a political issues, the political calendar and the politics that are really the most important factors that influence presidents' decisions.
It is 1400 hours Greenwich time, 10 a.m. Eastern time on the 24th. The XCOM is meeting. What do we do? Do we stop them? If they don't turn around, do we board them? Do we sink them? Suddenly, and it's as if there's a playwright here, Professor, a message comes that all six in Cuban waters have either stopped or reversed course. Now, that's not real time. We don't have that good a communication system yet, but it's a promising moment for the XCOM. This is where Dean Rusk gives us the metaphor that you feature, eyeball to eyeball. So on the 24th, they believe the crisis has passed, but it hasn't, Professor. They don't know about the Soviet submarines. They don't know about the 48,000 Soviet troops on the island. And they especially don't. Isn't it striking how none of them ask about Castro?
Well, the irony is that the news that the Soviet ships turned back comes minutes after President Kennedy authorizes actually attack on those ships.
Yes.
And that's why the Rusk says, okay, it's eyeball to eyeball, and the other guy blinked. The point is that the other guy blinked almost 24 hours earlier, sending the signal, but it takes hours and hours for this information to get to the White House. And when Khrushchev wants to inform Kennedy about something, he decides later in the crisis to send his messages by transmitting them through Radio Moscow, because sending a regular letter at that time, a message to the president, would take 24 hours. It has to be delivered to the embassy. It has to be deciphered, put into the coded mode again, and then sent, and so on and so forth. So really, they operate in dark. And they don't know much.
No.
They don't know much about what happened and what is coming next, exactly, the missiles.
Let's go into how ignorant they are on the 26th, because the moment of crisis has not passed. It's in front of us. The professor is Serhii Plokhii. Nuclear Folly is the book, The History of the Cuban Missile Crisis. I'm John Batchelor.